Good morning, everybody. 12th of November, 2 days after Edmund Fitzgerald Day, 1 day after Veterans Day, here on ADK Homeroom Podcast. This is your home away from homeroom. I am your host, Frank. It is Friday. Woohoo, Friday. Not just any Friday, but it is Red Notice Day. That's right, Red Notice Day here in my family. Going to fire up the R2-D2 popcorn maker tonight. If you don't have one, I highly recommend one if you have the means. It's great. You can pop off its head, turn it upside down, and then that's the bowl for the popcorn that his little droid body churns out. I'm going to sit down on the couch, turn on the fireplace, let the dog plop on my feet. Littlest one's going to burrow under the Afghan on my lap, and we're going to watch us some Ryan Reynolds, Dwayne Johnson, and Gal Gadot action. I point out that it has that perfect Red Notice. I haven't seen it yet, but it has that perfect, perfect review profile that you like to see. 45-50% critics on Rotten Tomatoes and 91% positive from users. That is exactly what you want, right? You don't want anything too high from the critics. If it's too high from the critics, you know it's just because the movie's so politically correct that the reviewers are afraid of stepping out of line and being tarred and feathered and canceled for reviewing it badly. Or maybe it just means that their movie's pulling some insider crap that only appeals to 300 movies a year, to people who watch 300 movies a year. And that doesn't make it a good movie, right? If you're just appealing to people who watch 300 movies a year, that doesn't make you good, right? If I do a lesson in class that only appeals to three kids in the class who know the most about physics, is that a good lesson? No. No, that is not a good lesson. It's always funny to me. A lot of the same people who claim to be against elitism are the same people who say that only the experts should be allowed to set tastes and make judgments about art. I guess somehow they lose their way between the E words, expert and elite. It's silly. All right, now, today's topic, also about some self-styled elites, namely the elites who are into altruism. And, of course, since this is a rationalist podcast, special attention goes to the so-called rational altruists over at Effective Altruism. But it's not just about them. We're going to talk about altruism in general, as it is practiced by most folks, because there is a big problem out there. A huge problem. A middle school volleyball level problem. Allow me to explain. First, how is altruism practiced? Well, you know, over at EA, you can see that they practice something called cause neutrality, right? Cause neutrality means that an altruist has to be neutral when surveying the causes and deciding which cause to support. In other words, she has to sort of compare the relative importance of different causes and then look at the resources that she has available and divvy up her resources. And this is not just past resources, but present and future resources. Logically, she has to divvy these up objectively. And most importantly, effectively, right? That's in their name over at Effective Altruism. And I would say that not only the sort of modern altruists, the rationalist altruists at EA, but also if you look at the Christian churches that are around, really any sort of charitable organization is going to want to, as far as they can tell, as far as they can justify to themselves, is going to want to be effective, right? Unless you're just one of these CEO leeches that's in it, Red Cross in the past, if you're just one of those CEO leeches who's just there to siphon off money, then you want your charity to be effective. But there is this question, right? Effectiveness begs the question, effective for whom? When I donate, I definitely acknowledge the selfishness in a lot of my donations, right? I donate to the Arts Center where my kids take classes. I donate to schools where my kids are, Rotary, because they have direct impact on a lot of the things that we do here in the community, Scouts. Donate to the Pismo Beach Disaster Relief Fund because I love Pismo Beach. Who doesn't? Miss Geist loves it. Everybody loves Pismo Beach. So I recognize the selfishness there. But in the broader altruism movement, it is claimed that people should do some sort of objective analysis and find the best way to spend their money through some utilitarian calculation that is best for humanity as a whole. And they would reject, they would laugh at the idea that there is any sort of selfishness in the analysis that they are doing. And that's my point. My point is that a lot of this sort of altruism that is going on out here, it really is very, very selfish. And not necessarily in the enlightened selfish way, right? Where it's kumbaya and I just want what's best for everyone in the world and blah, 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 blah. No, I mean it's selfish in that it's you're doing what is best for you. You're doing what you are personally interested in. Here is my main argument that there is a single cause that would be best to donate to. And most of the people in the rationalist altruist movement would, I think, agree with that if we could only discover it, right? They claim that cause prioritization is important, and only because of uncertainties should you do this sort of scattershot shotgun approach where you donate to lots of different things. And if you could find that number one cause change, then you should just keep donating to that. And, you know, the point is accurate that from a statistical mechanics point of view, the odds of two or more causes having exactly equal effectiveness are zero, right? It's not just going to happen. One is going to be, if you could only, and the finest resolution, resolve it, if you could detect it, one is going to be better than the others. Now, you know, the big objection would be, of course, people would say, hold on, Frank, of course there's one cause that's better than all the others, but we just don't know what it is. We give to all the different causes trying to figure out what is the best. That's a best approach when you don't have sufficient knowledge. Hmm. Well, okay. The problem with that is that the events of the last two centuries tell a different story. And they tell a story that we do have sufficient knowledge. Let me give you an example, or many examples. Much is made of the Great Stagnation, right? Take Jonathan Huebner's famous graph from his 2005 piece in the Journal of Technological Forecasting and Social Change. This was reproduced, of course, in Tyler Cowen's book, The Great Stagnation. And you see that patents, measure of innovation, peaked around 1914. Now, it is true also that that's been taken down a bit by Jonathan Smart over at accelerating.org. And he thanks Werner Vinge and Ray Kurzweil for feedback on his piece. And Smart claims that the patent data is a bit bogus. And it wouldn't really show too much of a drop-off if it had been done correctly. Overall, Smart thinks that Huebner is missing a lot of innovation because it's hard to measure. Smart says that the stagnation really wasn't happening. Innovation is significant for technology more than it's significant for humans, initiated by technology more than initiated by humans, whatever that means. And that sometimes the innovations are hard to see because of that. They're second level, in other words. The innovations, for example, he gives the interesting example of innovations occurring within virtual worlds. And he points out Second Life as an example. And hoo boy, that has not aged well, has it? If you've looked in on Second Life lately, not a whole lot of innovation going on over there. Sorry, John, definitely not. Even their website looks like it's from 1998 or maybe 2008 at the latest. Yeah, not a lot of innovation going on in that, and maybe in the internet as a whole, certainly there is innovation, but not really within a given app. You could maybe say World of Warcraft has advanced, but overall, it's still the same game. It's still the same game since 2004, and the advocates of the Great Stagnation have pointed out, you know, they're right. They pointed out things have slowed down, and the Great Stagnation, it's really just evident, I think, anecdotally to most of us. My grandfather was born in 1909. By the time he was 60, he'd gone from horses delivering milk bottles to his doorstep in a brownstone in D.C. to a man setting foot on the moon. That's a lot of progress from horse-drawn carts to a man on the moon. That's a lot of progress in 60 years. And then you got Paul Krugman, right? Paul Krugman writing that famous piece in 1996, and Ezra Klein revisited it in 2011 about kitchen technology, right? Just another example, kitchen technology. Fundamentally the same at the end of the 20th century, 2000, as it was in 1950, right? Krugman talks about his kitchen basically being the same as it was in the 1950s. And that includes microwaves, right? Microwaves were around. And when did Krugman write that article? 96, I guess, not quite 2000, but basically 2000, end of the 20th century. Microwaves were around then, but still, even with that, the change in kitchen technology from 1900 to 1950 was way greater than from 50 to 2000, right? I mean, in 1900, kitchens didn't have municipal water supply, didn't have the running water being piped in. That came in like sort of between 1900 and 1920. And even by then, a lot of rural kitchens didn't have it coming in. When it did make it in, your sink was the separate piece of furniture, right? That was, you had to leave it open underneath to prevent moisture gathering up there and decaying. It wasn't a built-in thing like now. Gas ranges were just coming in. In 1900, you were basically still cooking over wood or coal. It was basically a campfire in your kitchen. Refrigerators, forget about it. Technically, the first one was 1911, and yes, technically correct is the best kind of correct. But refrigerators really didn't become even a little popular until 1927. Even in 1927, famously, the GE Monitor Top fridge was more expensive than a Model T Ford, right? In 1927, when the Yankees were hammering their way into the history books. And the real popularity of refrigerators really not until like the 40s, until World War II. That's why my grandparents call it the ice box. When I went to my grandparents' house, right, it was the ice box still. It wasn't the refrigerator, it was the ice box, because that's what they grew up with. So huge change. And we haven't even left the kitchen, right? Huge change from 1900 to 1950, but nothing like it from 1950 to 2000. You know, microwaves were the biggest thing, and you compare a microwave to like the innovation of refrigerators and piped in water and cooking with something other than a campfire, wood or coal, you know, it's just clearly a slowdown in progress there, right? The transportation sector, you could look at that too. Cars and planes both came in between 1900 and 1950. And then from 1950 to 2000, did we get those flying cars? No. Did we get those self-driving cars? No, we're almost there, but are they really here? Definitely not. Can you go get a self-driving car that would cut down fatalities on the highways and the streets by maybe two-thirds, from 30-something thousand down to maybe 10,000? Would they cut that down? Yes. Can you buy one? No, they're not here yet. It doesn't count if we don't have them. You cannot count your self-driving cars before they are driving you. That's the rule. All right. And the internet was great, right? The internet was great advancement, but I think it obscures the lack of advancement in medicine, right? We didn't have anything like the invention of antibiotics over the last half of the 20th century or the start of the 21st century. Nothing like that. Space exploration, nothing compares to putting a man on the moon since 50 years ago, since 1970. So there really has been this great stagnation. And now lately, see, the thing is, folks like Cowan have been saying that the stagnation is showing signs of being over. I think that they are incorrect. They point to things like the blockchain. They point to things like the malaria vaccine and fusion power. And that fusion power, first of all, that's, we know how that goes, right? Lucy is going to yank the football away again. And the point is that if you're focusing your altruistic activities around this idea that the stagnation is going to be over, you're not making correct decisions, because we haven't seen it be over yet. Sure, there are signs, but fusion's been tantalizingly close for 50 years. You can't count on that. The malaria vaccine, that would be amazing, but defeating one disease, and really we could have had malaria under much better control if we hadn't been scared off DDT in the late 60s, right? The World Health Organization going back to recommending DDT around 2005, but that 30-year pause really, you know, killed millions of people, So we could have been doing malaria better on malaria vaccine if we hadn't slowed down on it, right? And nothing in medicine has been transforming society the way that antibiotics and anesthesia did. Things are, in fact, slowing them down. Well, what would speed them up? That's the point about altruism here, is that things have slowed down tremendously, and we can see why. We know why. If we could find that one root cause, and my contention is that we can, that one root origin, that force that through the green fuse drives the flower, as Dylan Thomas would put it, for all this amazing revolution since 1800, then that one root cause would be by far the number one place for altruists to concentrate their efforts. If we could go back to the one cause that improved life so almost immeasurably from 1800 to 1950, if we could go rediscover that cause and recapture it, then that would be the thing. That would be the place, hands down, right? 6:30, favorite time of day, hands down. That would be hands down the best place to focus our altruism. And anything else would be selfish, right? Right? 1800, think about it. 1800 is almost incomprehensible. 1800, 50% child mortality rate. I always say that because it would hurt so many people so much to go back to 50% child mortality rate before the age of five in 1800. Bringing that down to present levels, that alone, that advancement alone was worth all other so-called altruistic projects together. So can we go back to find that one main thing? Can we go back to that level of effectiveness and focus our efforts in improving the world on that one thing? I contend that we can. Now, it should be obvious that that one root cause is not what many of the altruists are spending their time on, right? Do you think that we had all this advancement from 1800 to 1950 because we chose the right breed of dog to focus our charities on? That's what your cause prioritization is focused on, folks? Which breed of dog should get our best charity, should get our best efforts? Come on. Do you think that airplanes and cars and indoor plumbing happened because we found the right country in Africa to send our postdocs to? This is not the way. Do you think that homes were electrified because we chose the right immigration policy? Do you think that the poor got enough to eat? And remember Deirdre McCloskey's great quote on this, right? She says, yes, from 1900 to 1950, with the great acceleration of capitalism and industrialization and freedom and liberty, Lillian Betancourt, yes, it's true, Lillian Betancourt did get another yacht, but the poor got enough to eat, right? Do you think the poor got enough to eat because we prioritized our causes correctly and chose the right foundation, doing the right research on the right kind of protein to raise and then give to kids once their protein came to fruition, if proteins could come to fruition? Do you think that antibiotics were invented because some altruistic guy did some sort of analysis and chose schistosomiasis control initiative over deworm the world initiative? Of course not. Of course freaking not. Absolutely not. The wonderful, amazing progress that was made from 1800 to 1950 that dwarfs anything that the modern altruists imagine out there. And that progress was enabled by raw, unbridled, unfettered, and most of all, fearless capitalism, right? People were allowed to fail. People were allowed to take risks. Most of all, people were allowed to die for what they believed in. They were allowed to pursue their happiness. And we have stopped allowing people to die for pursuing their happiness. We've stopped allowing people to take risks for what they believe in. It's really pretty obvious, folks. And I know you're saying out there, you're thinking, hey, you're just one dude on the internet. You really think you can point out the one cause of the great stagnation? All these other people out there thinking about the slowdown in innovation and what's going on. And they're saying it's this and it's this and we have to study that and maybe we should look at that. And you think you are the one guy who can point out that the stagnation is still going on. It is not slowing down. And you think you're the one guy who can point out that there's a solution and moreover, it's an obvious solution. Well, hell yes. Hell yes. I do think that. I think many could be, people could do it, not just me. I think many people could do it because it is obvious. And sometimes the obvious just needs to get a name before people focus on it, right? Von Clausewitz, he's famous for an obvious saying, right? Said war is an extension of politics, which I will never forgive him for not saying, right, that swordplay is an extension of wordplay, because that would have been much better. But, you know, war is an extension of the of politics. That's obvious, dude. That is obvious. And yet he's getting famous for saying that. Arthur C. Clarke, right, stating the obvious with his any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Well, yeah, that is obvious. No kidding. Sometimes you just need somebody, and it's not about the obvious. It's not about some amazing insight. It's not about some intellectual advancement. Sometimes it's about just being honest. Sometimes being pointing out the obvious is just having the guts, the courage to stand up and say, dude, the emperor is wearing no clothes, right? And I'm telling you that it is obvious from history that freedom and capitalism and taking risks and letting people develop is the way forward. All else is vanity. And that's what I mean by the selfishness of altruism, right? Vanity, all these other causes, deworming the world, right? Picking, not just deworming the world, but spending time and energy and focusing on which deworming initiative is the best. Saving dogs as much as you save people from hurricanes, and which type of dog to save. Treating people with cell phones and the newest Yeezys as if they are living in poverty. Eliminating factory farming. All this is vanity. You're pursuing your own vain ends. You are attempting to establish your own vain empires, as William Logan would have it. You are being vain to Carly Simon dimensions if you are pursuing different deworming initiatives ahead of capitalism, right? This is vanity. Canto 81, pull down thy vanity. I say pull down. Learn of the green world what can be thy place in scaled invention or true artistry. Pull down thy vanity. Packin, pull down thy vanity, how mean thy hates fostered in falsity, pull down thy vanity. That is from, of course, Pound, Canto 81. So yes, you are being selfish if you are not pursuing the main cause of the wonderful, amazing, stunning advancement from 1800 to 1950, which is, of course, freedom, liberty, capitalism, pursuit of happiness, letting people take risks. Everything else is vanity. Now, to sort of bring it back down here, this is called the middle school volleyball problem. The middle school volley problem. Volleyball problem. What do I mean by that? Well, have you ever seen one of those middle school volleyball games? The girls go out there and you're up in the bleachers with your paper bag of popcorn, and the volleyball game starts, and there's a serve and it goes out of bounds, and there's another serve and it goes out of bounds. And there's another serve, and this one lands inbounds, and the other team hits it, and it goes out of bounds, side out, as they say. And then there's a serve, and it goes out of bounds. And then there's a serve, and it goes inbounds, and it lands out. It's hit out. And then there's another serve, and it goes out of bounds. In other words, the rallies, the points in middle school volleyball, they don't last too long. And that most of the rallies, many of the rallies, never even start because the serve lands out of bounds. Moreover, if there is ever a good serve, like an actual whistler that comes in there, a screamer that just, you know, burns over the top of the net, It is never returned. So, over my years in education watching middle school volleyball, I asked the coaches, I watched these games, and then I asked the coach, and I say, so how much of practice time do you devote to the serve? And they say, you know, first 10 minutes, we practice serving, and then we go on and we do our hits and do our bumps and we do our plays and all this other stuff. And I'm looking at these games of like, they never go past the serve. 95% of all your points are decided by the serve one way or the other, whether it goes in bounds or not, or whether it's a good, you know, hard serve or not. It's all decided by the serve. So why isn't 95% of your practice time spent on the serve? I don't know. I don't get it. And it's been that way for 25 years. As long as I've been in education, every single time, middle school volleyball, it's 95% all about the serve. And yet you go to a middle school volleyball practice and you see them working on all kinds of other things. Just work on the freaking serve. That's what will get you farther. Wow. Then you can work on everything else. So that's what's going on here with altruism, right? You could work on your deworming initiatives. You can work on your which postdocs to which countries will establish the best return on postdoc investment. You can work on all that stuff after you've got the serve in place, after you've got the fundamental platform of liberty, capitalism, freedom to pursue happiness. After you've got that, then you can jump to, you know, which dog breed should be saved first when the storm surge comes up over the levees. After that, then you can focus on these other things. And if you're focused on those other things before the serve, then you're really just being selfish. And it's okay to be selfish. I'm not putting this podcast out there to say it's not okay to be selfish. It is okay to be selfish. However, if you're saying that you're not selfish and you're saying you're being altruistic, then there's a problem, right? Then you've got some hypocrisy. Then you've got a questionable judgment, because if you're trying not to be selfish and yet you're focusing on anything but the number one cause, focus on anything except that serve in the middle school volleyball game, then you're really not attacking the heart of the issue. And that is a problem. All right, folks. Remember to subscribe. I hope you have a great weekend. Hope you get to see that red notice, or maybe Love Hard or something. Some sort of amazing modern entertainment that's out there this weekend. Maybe you'll read My Brilliant Friend from Elena Ferrante, and then you will think, oh my goodness, is that really what that sort of friendship is about? I'm about to finish that book myself, and I am puzzling over its reception in various intellectual circles. All right, so you guys have a good weekend. Enjoy some great art, and don't forget to work for the future. And focus on the serve. Take care.